boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, lads and lassies, and those that don't subscribe to a gender, welcome to the Pod of the Dragon podcast. This is a reaction podcast. Spencer, we just watched episode 3 of HBO's House of the Dragon. What did you think?
I thought it was a very solid episode. It had some rough patches, particularly at the start, but it just had a build up to it that was going throughout the entire thing, and then ending with a climax of Daemon Targaryen soloing an army, which I'm sure has you at about an 11 right now.
Oh, huge Daemon fan here, as I've covered on this podcast many times. This was his shining moment. I mean, like, you know, obviously, if you've read the books, you know, especially if you've read Fire and Blood, you know that Daemon does eventually kill the crab feeder. And he kills him in one-on-one combat, and they allowed it. I'm a little bummed it happened off-screen, but there was a dramatic element to him pulling that half-body out of the cave like that. I will tell you, in the books, he takes his head. He doesn't take half his body. That was a sort of strange change. I don't know.
Head was there, too.
I don't know why they made that change. But I'll tell you, the Daemon part of this episode had me going absolutely bananas. I thought this was a really, really good episode. I think that this episode will probably land more with the casual audience because they got to see the stuff they want to see in Game of Thrones, which is the palace intrigue, the potential romance, the who's going to tell, you know, like the infighting. And then they end with the sort of Fire and Blood, the dragon, the battle. And it actually harkened back to the Battle of the Bastards episode, obviously, right? When it looked John. it looked like all was lost for John. It looked like he had gone out on his own on a one person thing. Everybody's coming, running at him. Everything slows down. The music builds. He pulls his sword. He's ready to fight the army one-on-one, and then the reinforcements come in. So there's a very good parallel to Battle of the Bastards, which Miguel Sapochnik did. So I really enjoyed that part of it. I thought this was a fantastic episode. I really anticipate a lot of positive reviews from this.
Again, I very much enjoyed it. Honestly, though, my favorite scenes were not the Stepstones. As much as I thought this entire episode would be just straight-up Stepstones combat.
That's what I was hoping for.
We also got Sea Smoke appearing on
screen. Yeah, wait a second. Hold on.
You got to eat some crow
right now. Wait a second.
I was right.
I am bowing. I'm bowing and asking you for your eternal forgiveness. Spencer absolutely called this correctly.
Thank you.
That the Valyrians, while not dragon lords, they are drawing the distinction, are indeed dragon riders.
Laenor
Valyrian, that was not Caraxes he was riding. So anybody who was confused, that was his dragon, Sea Smoke. So he is a dragon rider. So the Valyrians are dragon riders, which means we probably spoiled a pretty good plot element in our last episode, which I think I did. But you are 100% right about that. The distinction here, folks, is that they are not dragon lords, meaning they do not breed dragons. They do not necessarily own them, but they can ride dragons.
And as we've discussed before, dragons are bonded to a particular individual. So this is clearly not like he just picked this one up for today and is riding it like, you know, an Enterprise rent-a-car. This is his dragon.
Yes, his dragon. In the same way that Daemon's dragon is Caraxes, this is his dragon.
Right. And I think one thing that we'll see how they do it, but one way they may be trying to balance out the somewhat differing points we've got in the show is that it may be now that they've married into House Targaryen, now they're establishing their own line of dragon riders, whereas the Sea Snakes generation and earlier hasn't been. Maybe that's how they're doing it. We'll have to see in the show. But regardless, we got our third dragon in here, and I was excited about it. But really, my favorite scenes in the episode were honestly the moments of just discussion around King's Landing in the Kingswood, moments between Rhaenyra and Criston Cole, moments between Rhaenyra and her dad, the Hightowers doing all sorts of Hightower things. All of that was great. It was wonderful dialogue. It was wonderful character interactions. The characters are just really bringing it. I was glad to see that, because it wasn't what I expected. I thought we would just spend an entire hour just watching Daemon and the Sea Snake kill people from Essos and the Stepstones. We got a bit of that. And shall we say this? I was a little bit worried previously that whether Matt Smith... We discussed this in our text between episodes this week. I was worried about whether they'd showed the adequate amount of violence and dangerousness and physicality out of Daemon as a character, because it was an aspect of him we hadn't seen yet. Do you feel that Matt Smith brought what he needed to in this episode?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, he absolutely brought physicality. I mean, as much as we saw Kit Harington, you know, slinging a sword around and cutting people down, I mean, I feel like it was right on par with what we saw in a lot of those battle scenes with Kit Harington.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think he absolutely delivered as far as the physicality of the role. I think Matt Smith is doing a great job. I think if you have problems with the cast, the acting, Matt Smith is not where you're going to land, right? He's doing more than his part. He's carrying it pretty well. I think he's done a great job. And by the way, when I read The Rogue Prince and I read Fire and Blood, I never envisioned Damon to be a big, bulky, like strong guy. Like I don't know why people had that mental image. It's not uncommon. Yeah, but I didn't have that. Like, so I've not had that same sort of hiccup with it, with the casting, because I've always thought of him as more of like a lanky, like toned, muscular, really good fighter. Because you know, really huge, bulky guys aren't great sword fighters. Like, you need to be kind of like long and flexible, pliable, that sort of thing. So that's where my mind always went with him. I do have a question for you about the Stepstones battle scene, though.
Please.
I think here's my read on what they were doing, right?
Okay.
We had the discussion when Damon was still out there just laying waste to everything with Caraxes.
As about, he does.
Hey, how are we going to pull the crab feeder out of these caves?
Mm-hmm.
And the Seasake was like, why don't we get Damon to do it? He's crazy as fuck. He'll do it. Absolutely, he'll do it. And his brother, Snake that he is, was awful.
Mm-hmm.
And then Damon gets word from his brother that he's going to help. Damon, let's pause on the reaction that Damon had to that for a second. I do want to, as Damon's defense attorney, explain this to the casual.
I don't think it's that difficult to interpret, but let's see. Yeah.
Well, I want to take his back on it, is what I mean.
Sure.
All right. And then from there, we are meant to believe that Damon angrily goes off half-cocked, jumps out, pretends, which is, by the way, I mean, honor right out the door. This is not a normal thing to be doing in this society. Pretend to wave the white flag and then fight on. But he does so. And we are meant to think all of the time that he is doing this on his own. Now, then the Valyrians come to help. The Valyrian fleet and army come to help. And so you have this sort of decision tree of, is this sort of like when John went off half-cocked in the Battle of the Bastards and they just followed him anyway, even though he was being crazy? Or was this a plan amongst all of them together? Because we got that little bit from Corlys about where his head was at, where he was thinking, hey, we can get Damon to pull him out. And then we kind of see that play out later. So which side of that did you think this really landed?
Very much the second option. We saw them discuss it. We saw them say that this would be necessary to draw him out. We saw specifically Damon looking expectantly for when the Valyrian knights would then be backing him up to support him. Valyrian knights and mercenaries that are coming with. And it was all perfectly timed to happen along that way, along the exact lines they discussed as who is important enough that will actually get the crab feeder to you know, commit his resources. So, I'm very much in camp two. This isn't impromptu. This is a strategic plan based on the fact that Damon is utterly terrifyingly fearless in terms of being willing to commit himself to that risk for that particular operation.
I agree. I think it was a plan. I think it was planned all along, because I think another thing they were doing, they were playing with the filmmaking of having us think, and I fell victim to this, of thinking that Damon was looking for Caraxes. That he was looking up. The crab feeder was constantly looking to the sky. I constantly go back to the bond between dragon and dragon rider. I thought what they were going to do is have Caraxes come in, save the day type thing. But in reality, what Damon was doing is this was part of the plan, and he was looking for the backup soldiers, and they eventually did come.
Mm-hmm.
Damon had still put himself at huge physical risk. This was not, like, he was not safe during this by any stretch of the imagination.
No. He could have died at any point.
But I do think it was all part of the plan for sure. And it was funny, cause I was watching it with my wife, and all of this goes down, and then Damon takes off for the cave, and I was like, hey, honey, you think the crab feeder stands any chance against Daemon Targaryen? She just busts out laughing. And then, of course, it's such a non-fight, we don't even see it. Why? Because, none of these guys, which we saw, are a match for Daemon Targaryen. None of the crab feeders.
With Dark Sister? God, no.
None of them. But this guy in particular has grayscale, so he certainly wasn't a good one-on-one fighter.
Yeah. The portrayal the show did of the crab feeder is very different than the books, at least from what little information we got. But I really
He doesn't have grayscale in the books.
No, he's just an admiral of Mir. That's all we really know about him. I really actually like the portrayal that we've got this episode, though, for a few reasons. One, I appreciate his caution and intelligence by how slowly he commits himself. That every step of the game, he's like, well, this is obviously a trap. You four guys do it. Okay, he's charging. You five guys go there. Still no dragon. Okay, rest of you guys get going. they showed
he knew
him,
what was going on, yeah.
He knew what was going on, but he kept on going like, all right, let's commit a little bit farther. And they slowly were able to draw him out by essentially Daemon Targaryen doing the most suicidal thing they could possibly imagine.
And taking two arrows, by the way. Taking two arrows.
I also like how they actually portrayed the fight. I know in the books it's this epic duel that all the Bowwoods write about. But as you said, it wouldn't really make sense for the Crabfeeder as they portrayed him to be much of a fighter. And I in some ways appreciate where a big bad guy doesn't have to be badass by means of their own physical ability. It's by their command and by their strategic efforts. And in terms of him retreating into the cave and Daemon just returning with the body, that's just a wonderful playing with history kind of moment of, you know that all of the ballads would then fill in the gap with what happened. They, all of them, with what information they had, would just go, well, here's a blank space that I can describe an epic duel in. And then they would step in to do it.
Which it probably wasn't an epic duel at all. Daemon probably just walked up and cut him in half. Because, you know, the Crabfeeder had grayscale. He was limited in his mobility, and he probably wasn't capable of fighting with Daemon one-on-one anyway, even when he was healthy.
No, but we did still get a great duel kill this episode of when Rhaenyra almost essentially soloed that boar on the ground. Kudos to her.
Yeah, well,
Kristen Cole helped. He helped. He gave it a little stab, but she went full on knife to the
throat. Yeah, he stabbed it, and when he stabbed it, that fucking sword got a couple inches from her face.
Yes.
All right, so we talked to... So anything else you want to cover about the Stepstones?
We didn't get that much. I mean, it was much more of a secondary part of things. It seemed like from the preview for next episode, we're going to get a lot more of Daemon being self-declared king of the Stepstones, but... What we got was a nice battle.
Not self-declared. How dare you, sir? Others declare him king of Stepstones.
The equivalent of the 1,000 people he brought declared him.
Let me explain. I do want to explain a couple things to people who might be confused. So you might wonder, how can Corlys Velaryon have half the fleet, half the royal fleet, but still struggle with enough men to fight what looks like, I don't know, a couple hundred people that the Crabfeeder has? Well, the reason for that is that the fleet that Corlys Velaryon has is not a king. These are not people who are like basically indentured servants, right? He has to pay the people who, you know, use his ships for commerce out of his own pocket. So a lot of these people, you even made the distinction when you were talking earlier, some of these were like soldiers/mercenaries because most of the ships that he has are for trade, which he talks about.
He's a merchant lord.
And he pays people for trade. So he doesn't actually have a ton of swords.
No.
Like at his back of actual pure soldiers. He's got a lot of ships and a lot of people, but it's a lot of people who are in his employ to take cinnamon from point A to point B, not necessarily to grab a sword and go run in a cave. So that's kind of how you can square the two things. Second thing, I want to point something out here.
Please.
While it is not smart to ever literally beat the messenger, Daemon had every right to be frustrated with his brother.
And
every
with himself.
Every fucking right to be frustrated with his brother. His brother was going to let him languish out there for years, failing. He's known.
Great part of three of them, yeah.
He's known that they've struggled for years and years and years. And right at the very end, he's going to send in just a massive number of men to come in and just win. And by the way, in the message, he says us. He says, yes. We are not succeeding in this war. So the deuce is up. Two middle fingers to Viserys. Mm-hmm. I'm with Daemon on this one. Should you, however, just like PSA out there for all the boys and girls, should you ever actually beat the messenger? I'm going to go no with that one. Bad look for Daemon, but his anger was justified.
I mean, it was a very understandable anger of where the sole reason he went to the Stepstones with the Sea Snake in the first place was to overcome the label of the Second Son. It was to chart his own destiny. It was to prove his own worth. It was to represent to the people of Westeros that he can actually accomplish great things and do things to protect the realm. That's why he went out there to do this. And for for 2.5 years, it's been defying him just through this long-term war of attrition that was not what they, you know, were ready for or really had the resources to accomplish. And now, as you said, the 11th hour, his brother says, don't worry, I'm here to help you. This will be our victory. And Daemon's like, Well, fuck that noise. I did this. This is what I've come here to accomplish. I'm now going to do the most suicidal thing possible to prove and do what's necessary to win the day before any of your guys even get here.
And if you wanted a great in-world explanation for the fervor which the Sea Snake's men were fighting with, is the fact that Daemon literally got, they watched it.
Yeah.
He got a scroll from the king that said, I got a ton of people coming, I'll take you back. He could have played the prince and said, I have saved the day, I have done it. Instead, what does he do? He says, fuck that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going personally. Come with me if you want, and I'm going to end this right now. That's a guy I can get behind. I'm just going to say, that would inspire loyalty.
No doubt, no doubt.
Shout out Daemon Targaryen. Let's give him a round of applause.
Kudos indeed. Well done to him. Tell me though, I haven't heard from you. What did you think about the other parts of this episode? Because we spent 85% of our time far away from the Stepstones.
I think I finally got a real understanding of why George R. R. Martin says he likes this version of a series better than the version that he wrote.
It's certainly a lot more developed and a lot more interesting. Just being,
yeah.
Guy on the page, I knew he was a king. I knew he was roughly ineffectual. I knew he tried to make everybody happy. About all I got out of it. This guy has multitudes of complexity and pressures and competing forces inside of his soul. And that is just bleeding off the screen.
And he's got a melancholy that I think George likes in his rulers. I think he likes the idea that ruling is a very solitary thing in this type of monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's being portrayed really well. I think the actor, Paddy Considine, is doing a great job. I think that they're rounding that character out. Now, it's very different, right? So if you're a Viserys fan, if you read the books, and I don't know why you would, but if you read the books and you're like, I really like this Viserys,
yeah,
then you're probably frustrated with this, right? Because there's way more flaws, to me, apparent, in the character I'm seeing on screen, but it's also a more rounded, more relatable character. I will say this, that in the book, him and Rhaenyra, from what we know, again, unreliable narrator that is telling us the information in Fire and Blood, were tight.
Yes.
They were simpatico the whole fucking time. This thing of her getting mad, leaving them, screaming in public and all this, none of that is really given over to us. Now, could it have happened? Maybe. Again, unreliable narrator in Fire and Blood, but I do think they are caught, they're pulling at that relationship a little bit more in this story than the story we get in the books. To summarize, I think that it was great character development.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this was Mikhail Sapochnik saying, we, through no fault of our own, through absolutely no fault of our own, committed a heinous crime in how we portrayed a royal hunt in season one of Game of Thrones. And we are going to show you a real royal hunt. So shout out to them for that.
Well,
I also love the parallel of, and I was just sitting there screaming Bobby B quotes, gods, I was strong then.
Mm-hmm.
When Viserys was drunk on a hunt.
Oh yeah.
I was like, what?
My girlfriend was
my guy's on a hunt. He's being difficult. He's screaming at his hand, I don't want to hear about politics. And he's drunk as a skunk. This is King Bobby B.
But it was to the point that my girlfriend was turning to me the entire run of that saying, is the boar going to kill him? Is this history repeats? Is he going to die disemboweled by a boar just because that's what happens to kings in Westeros? And I'm just looking at her going, well, he is very drunk and acting very Bobby B right now.
Yeah. Start the damn joust before I piss myself.
You're casting some serious shade towards season one right now. Are you telling me that the epic royal hunt of season one of four guys marching through the woods with one wineskin and one spear did not impress you, sir?
Yeah, that was pretty rough. They obviously had run out of budget when they did that scene. Yeah, no, this was great. I mean, the big tent. What did you think about the inclusion of the Tywin and Jason Lannister?
I actually really like that element. It further expands our knowledge of what the lords are doing during this particular period. And B, it really does, it well set up one of the central tensions of this episode of the conflict between Viserys and Rhaenyra on the subject of what her role is. Is her role as that of an heir? Is her role as that of a essentially somebody that'd be auctioned off to secure other alliances? Is this an element of her choice? Is this something that he should control? And they built that up well through the introduction of the Lannisters in this episode, and it just continued to grow from there.
I also like that they establish where the Lannisters are in the hierarchy, because I think that, you know, by the time we get to the main series, the Lannisters are obviously above the Targaryens, but above pretty much everybody else in the realm. And here they're clearly not. Like, Rhaenyra's like, are you fucking kidding me? The Lannisters? I'm going to go out there on that shit heap Casterly Rock? No, hell no. Like, the dismissal of Jason Lannister, I thought was really good, because it does set the Lannisters in place. Now, the Lannisters are
still a powerful family.
They're still very, very, very powerful family.
They run
Lannisport and the whole thing, but not the whole Westerlands, but Lannisport. But I think it was her basically saying, if I'm going to marry somebody, it's going to be somebody of a little higher stature than the fucking Lannisters.
Well, at this point, they're still the Lord Supreme of the Westerlands, even though they don't necessarily have the same power throughout Westeros they are. But yeah, I agree. I think they've
framed... I'm not sure we know that.
I think that's been the case ever since the Field of Fire, of where the around that period. But we'll double check this off camera. For right now, I do very much agree.
Well, I read the Dance of Dragons and Fire and Blood today, so it's like it was fresh, not established in that.
Okay.
I can tell you that.
But I did love how dismissal she was of the proposition. Of where he asked her, "Oh, have you been to the Rock, my lady?" And she's like, "Yeah, I think when I was 7, and it was like, you know, when I went to nope. see the Statue of Liberty, and I just kind of vaguely remember I was there."
I think I got a postcard. Did I get a postcard?
I think I got a postcard. Yeah,
shot glass. I don't know.
Maybe I just got seasick on the boat. Yeah, you know, these things, they all blend together.
Yeah, I don't know. And I thought Jason Lannister's proposition to her was
presumptuous,
pretty fucking sideways. I mean. Yeah, he was really talking down to her in a way. He was not talking to her like she was the heir of the Seven Kingdoms. That's for fucking sure. I will say that the Sir Criston Cole stuff with Rhaenyra, I thought was extremely well done. The back and forth between the two of them, how it's abundantly clear to me that Rhaenyra has interest in Sir Criston Cole. I am not 100% sure that he has the same interest in her. Just to remind all of our listeners out there, the Kingsguard do swear a vow of chastity when they become the Kingsguard. So he is, obviously that's kind of hard to tell in the main series because Jaime was just fucking everything, but like he's supposed to be celibate. So if he were to make any sort of move with Rhaenyra, it would be against his vows, obviously. So I think that was portrayed extremely well, the chemistry between the two of them.
It was. I really did like that. I really did like their scenes together. I think it well set up what is going to be a bit of a tension going forward in a lot of ways between vows and duty and commitment to your own cause versus the realm. I think that was all well portrayed. A little off scene I also quite liked is the idea that as much as Otto Hightower is a power, is a man with power.
Hey, fuck him. Fuck Otto Hightower. I just have to say that every single time.
It's required. Yes. Loyal member of the black cause that you are. I liked in this episode they did also establish that he is just a second son who is in some ways beholden to his brother's will. So we got to spend a lot more time with Lord Hightower this episode, and it was pretty clear that he was like, hey, this is what I want, Otto. You're going to make that happen, right, Otto? And Otto's just going to have to ask to a certain degree grin and bear it himself, and then the shit rolls downhill onto his daughter and everybody else too.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. So we talked a little bit about how are they going to be able to create some sympathy for the Greens?
Mm-hmm.
I found myself, so I'm a black all day long, all day, day one, since day one, I'm a black. I did find myself though going, man, wouldn't it be a lot easier if he would just name it? You know what I'm saying? Like the way they present it, I think it will logic most of the viewers into going, well, Why don't they just make Aegon king? Like, this doesn't make any sense why he's continuing to push Rhaenyra when, by his own admission, he only named Rhaenyra because the only other option at the time was Daemon. He didn't know he was going to have a boy, and now he's kind of stuck in this weird thing. And ultimately, the Dance of the Dragons, ultimately the entire conflict and the downfall of the Targaryens and their dragons, et cetera, can be linked to Viserys' indecision. Because he, at this point, right now, needs to make a call. And he's kind of riding the line. And it looks like, toward the end of the episode, it looks like he made the call right. But I did find myself, though, going, if he, think about it. Another world, Spencer.
Yes.
If he'd have just said, sorry, Rhaenyra, Aegon's going to be king. Targaryen's still in power? Like, are they still in power now? They might be, right? So I don't know. I think that's how they are going to get a lot of people on the cause of the Greens.
We've discussed this before. The most important job of any royal is securing the line of succession and making it beyond debate, beyond challenge, with no basis for civil war or whatever else to follow. That's their job more than anything else. It's the justification for why monarchy exists, is that it resolves that issue of who comes next. That's it. That's what you've got to do. Viserys, though, as he expressed this episode, is a man who wants to make everybody happy and is unable to accept that that's just not always possible. He struggles with the idea that each decision he makes is going to make somebody happy and somebody unhappy, and so his tendency then is to do nothing, so that way at least nobody's unhappy, and the realm suffers for it.
Spencer, what would you do in his situation? Right now, you're Viserys, right now at the middle of this episode, what would you do?
Middle of this episode, what would I do in terms of, like, the line of succession?
Yeah.
I've declared Rhaenyra. The lords have accepted Rhaenyra. Rhaenyra is my heir, and I will further reiterate it. What I would have done earlier is make that much more publicly apparent longer. The problem he's made is that
he went a different way. You went a different way. You shocked me. I thought you would have said named Aegon the heir.
No, I think his biggest mistake so far is that he's continued to marginalize her. He could have done so much to build up her base of power, to make her the public heir, to make her a key part of his council at every point, but he has made her an object of ridicule by not treating her seriously in public in that regard. And that is a big problem that has invited this debate and challenge among the lords about who the real heir is or real heir is going to be. She's like, well, it's got to be Aegon because he's never really treated her seriously as his heir. Why would I support her when she's a woman and everything else? And the king himself is not treating her like an heir. We should never have reached that point to start, much less going forward.
Shout out, Spencer. You're the White House counsel for the blacks. That's what you are. We're going to appoint you counsel for the blacks. I will say a couple things just to point out in this episode. If you like Lionel Strong, you know, if you were impressed by Lionel Strong.
Yes.
That's not by accident. Lionel Strong actually went to train at the Citadel to be a maester. He got six chains. Six links before he decided he did not want to be a maester anymore. So his appointment as master's law, while he is a bit rotund, balding, his last name Strong, you might think him dumb. He is not a dumb man. His appointment as master of laws was very purposeful, and it made an awful lot of sense for him to be master of laws. So if you continue to be impressed with him, you should be.
I think it's a wonderful continuation, too, where he is a great character, he has incredible abilities, and they've set it up so well that he is always the guy that is there to give the king good advice about what the king should do. It seemed like the king acknowledged it this episode, of where the king didn't really want to hear it in terms of the advice, but then once the advice started to roll in of, hey, you know how your connections with House Valyrian have gotten a little bit frayed lately? So, I recommended this before. This is still an option, and it could work in all these kind of ways. And the king is at first pissed, and then Patty being such a great actor, it slowly just starts to, even through his drunken haze, bleed into him of, so much of this is making sense, I'm going to give you a firm, drunken pat on the back as I walk past you in recognition of, I appreciate the good counsel you're always trying to give me.
Yeah, that solid move to go, well, no, I wasn't going to bring my son up at all. No, of course not.
Appreciate the honor you gave me by even
son's name, by the way. Lionel Strong's son's name, Breakbones.
Great title. Great title.
You're going to want to remember that name. He comes up again in the story.
Yeah, he will.
I do love that the presentation to me of Laenor is very positive. I feel like we all leave this episode impressed that Laenor was willing to stick up for Daemon. That he's a dragon rider. He came in, he saved the day, he's putting himself at physical risk, et cetera, et cetera. I love that there's some sympathy for Laenor Valyrian.
That he served on the council, that he is in, that he's not just, you know, a stuff lord sitting at a table. He was directly recommending and guiding strategy and challenging his uncle with respect to loyalty.
Yeah. They were like, hey, we're gonna marry you, Rhaenyra, to Laenor Valyrian if he survives this fucking war that he's in.
Yeah.
Shout out. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I love that line, too. And I loved how that was being emphasized to the king, too, about, hey, I know you don't really want to commit yourself to this, but this is the marriage alliance I'm recommending, and, oh, yeah, for it to work, he does need to live till tomorrow. So, so yeah, that was well done, too. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think one of the weakest moments of the episode was just an odd bit of forced humor at the very start of when we start with a wonderful scene of a Valerian knight getting chained to a wooden post, or stigmated to a wooden post. And then Caraxes swoops in and he's cheering, yeah, yeah, Damon, come save me. And then Caraxes just steps on him. That was so Bambi versus Godzilla to me that I just like, oh, I'm just rolling my eyes at that kind of forced humor there. So it didn't give me a great taste in my mouth to start, but the episode only improved going forward.
Interesting. I didn't take that as humor at all. I took that as an indication, further indication of how the little guy just doesn't factor
crushed
in.
Crushed underfoot.
It just doesn't factor in. I mean, it might be a little on the nose, right? But it doesn't, he just doesn't factor in. And like, yeah, like the Valerian soldier, he's rooting for Damon, et cetera. But Damon's, unfortunately, Damon's not there for that guy. And that's becomes very apparent.
It was either humorous or, as you said, it was just very on the nose, but it didn't strike me right. But from that point onward,
it didn't strike my wife right either. Sarah rolled her eyes at that too. It didn't bother me because I was like kind of hoping that is how it got displayed. That guy thinking that Damon was there to champion him, we would all learn that he really wasn't, and that's exactly how it got done. But my wife was right there with you.
But again, other than that, other than a couple of the quibbles we'll get into in our longer review, I thought this was a successful episode. I thought it had some great moments. I thought it had some wonderful acting between characters. It's continuing to successfully round and complete my understanding of characters that previously had nothing more written about them than like three paragraphs in a book. And it's done so in a way that I find successful and compelling, and that is a kudos to quality writing on the show.
Yeah, I thought this was the strongest episode so far because of the character development. You know, I can really draw a parallel to Rings of Power. If anybody's watched the first couple episodes of Rings of Power, I feel like this show gives you a couple characters and you go deep, as opposed to a lot of characters and you go shallow, right? Mm-hmm. The couple characters, and we are going very deep with Rhaenyra, and that is very, very good and very, very important. And I love that the show's doing that. And they're giving a lot of screen time to Rhaenyra and her thoughts, her frustrations, the fact that she's not perfect. She is a little petulant in that conversation with Viserys when he's trying to talk to her at the end. I mean, I'm a big fucking Rhaenyra supporter, and she was kind of difficult. Right?
She was being a difficult teenage daughter.
Exactly. So I love that we're getting enough screen time to really go deep with some of these characters. And I think that the battle scene there on the Stepstones is worth the price of admission. I thought they did a wonderful job with that. Shout out Miguel Sapochnik. So, altogether, I rate this as the highest episode I've seen so far.
I would rate it in parallel to episode one. I think it did some things very well, but I think it is consistent with the episodes we've seen previously on the show, and that is a high compliment for what we had so far.
Cool. Any other concluding thoughts here on a reaction pod?
Shall we have a bow for our new king of the Stepstones in terms of what he's accomplished, the new lord of the Narrow Sea?
All hail Daemon Targaryen, first of his name! King of the Andals, the first men, the Stepstones, and all that come with it.
He is stepping on Viserys' turf with that title, sir.
Well, the Andals and the first men who happen to be at the Stepstones at this moment.
Just the people on this archipelago. That's all I meant when I said that. I'm
just
issuing
a few
retraction.
Here. All right. This is a lot of fun. Loved talking the episode with you. We will be back with you, remember, Tuesday or Wednesday of this coming week with a much longer reaction pod. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and we'll be back with you later this week to talk more.